ability to embrace this representation of feminist leaders, and how that seems to have become even more pronounced in the face of HIV/AIDS pandemic on the continent. Can you just talk a bit about how that legacy is now continuing, or your sense of what's happening in sort of mainstream work on that legacy? So I'm just thinking of the first email and how it testifies to a student at Sussex who is obviously totally blown away. I mean, obviously they're impressed by the amazing text, but there are obviously certain ideas that seem to be totally new. Now that's very, very disturbing. And it makes me think of just how deeply embedded a certain tradition still is. So just your comments on the fact that this tradition isn't just kind of, being phased out. It's still very much there.
Yes, and I think that is why it's extremely important that we chant as many of these out, because yesterday I talked about a Canadian radio producer.
Maybe tell us again.
I received a request from a Canadian radio producer who claimed to be very progressive, and she hosts this very progressive program, and she wanted to record me to ask a few questions, interview me about the video. And I said, fine. And she has obviously read the whole reader. Because what I did, I asked her to send me some of the questions that she might be asking so that I think about the answers deeply. And she did. She sent me 20 very long questions, which showed that she had actually read, but which also proved to me that the main object of this reader, which was to debunk stereotypes about African sexuality. And in each of the pieces here, which Ruby really tried to do that, it just went over. She didn't get it at all. She started by emailing me and saying, first of all, can you suggest some songs that on African sexuality that I should play? At an interview, So if it had been a book about American sexuality, do you think she would have asked an American author or editor to suggest songs about so this, again, perceiving African sexuality as exotic, interesting, weird, and here's a book. Okay, and of course there were two questions about, tell me more about this practice of people jumping over warm legs. There's a piece in here that talks about that practice in a particular context. But she immediately picked on that one. Or this, tell me more about this practice of a man urinating on one spot. Just doing exactly what I was so mad. And I thought to myself, and then she went ahead to suggest, she said, I realize that most of the pieces in the reader talk about HIV/AIDS. That is simply not true. So then I thought to myself, should I do this interview and try to correct? But I was too angry. I said, why should we, because this is exactly what the book, she read the book. So, these, what are they? The biased views is the word I'm looking for. Prejudices. Thank you. These prejudices that people have about any of these oppressive structures or systems, whether it is racism or homophobia, are so deeply embedded that it would take much more that we're reader. That's why I'm imploring all of you to write more and more, so that they throw it in their faces until they have to stop and actually, you know, internalize what they're saying. Because obviously this Canadian radio producer had not internalized what she had read. But she was doing exactly what, you know. And you keep hearing, you know. Because I guess something that has taken centuries to, you know, these oppressive systems and ideologies and discourses that have taken centuries to, you know, entrench themselves, it will take much more than a reader of a few articles to uproot and to, you know, for people to unlearn. I talk about unlearning here, and I talk about being empathizing and being very sensitive, but obviously that it will take much more than that.
Isn't that the problem with liberalism, is the inability to see where you stand and how you see things? And so that, I mean, that for us is the difficulty in writing as well. If we're talking broadly to produce knowledge in the broader field of the production of knowledge around sexualities, we are so extremely dominated by what is considered the right way of looking at it. Even if we write into that field, we are marginalized within that field as weird. I mean, your book is weird. And I don't know how we start creating our own production of knowledge, like AGI has, for instance, the feminist effort, trying to say, let us produce knowledge that is relevant here and that can speak to the other knowledge, but still it's so dominant. I don't know how we do it. How do we overcome that? For myself, I'm doing research on same-sex marriages in South Africa, and I've been starting to think about getting away from the idea of same-sex, focusing on marriage, and what does marriage mean to people? And why does marriage for same-sex partners, why is it that different to heterosexual people who are married? To try and find that common ground in the importance of the relationship rather than in the identity.
Mm-hmm. And marriage, why is it so important? That same-sex people that have subverted dominant gender, and we want to buy into that very oppressive institution called marriage, the only legitimate way to have sex is when it has been stamped in the marriage certificate. Why aren't we challenging? I agree with you absolutely. We need to. I've just been to Jen's class, and she was talking about the Malawian couple, the gay couple. And for them, they were engaging in a heterosexual marriage because one of them, for all intents and purposes, identified as a woman. So it's not even about same sex, but it is much more complex. So yes, we need to think about our own ways and that's what I was saying. There's so much about sexuality. Very interesting issues. Very complex issues that cannot be reduced to same-sex marriage, for example.
My question is kind of related to Desiree, but it's got to do with you know, your point about growing up in Zambia, right, there's something that happens when we are talking about sexualities, and we wouldn't use that word, in the context of, say, a classroom, or in the context of, say, going to the doctor. There's something that happens, say, when we're talking about what we know about our bodies and what we can do with our bodies as Zambian women. So, for example, if I'm having a discussion with my colleagues around sexual pleasure and disease and so on, which would happen, which wouldn't, you know, there's certain places it would happen, and there's certain places it wouldn't happen. But I find that the kind of, how can I say, these broad words like culture start getting used when we enter classrooms. They start getting used when we enter conference spaces. When I'm having those very discussions about the same topic in relation to our lives and what we know, and maybe it's in preparation for a wedding, maybe it's a kitchen party, or some ceremony is going on, and then all this stuff, you know, comes out. It's not called rights, it's not called sexuality, it's not called culture. It's things we know, that we know. and then, so there's something that happens when, including myself, I enter the classroom space and I'm doing my teaching or my research or my writing, that then the word culture and rights get deployed. That wipes all that out, you know, and makes it like that's not real knowledge. So I have this really huge challenge that I don't know how to address it. So every time I go home to Zambia now in December, I tell myself that every event is an ethnographic study of various sexualities and performances of masculinity and femininity, and I have a whale of a time in my head. And I'm going crazy because then when I get to the literature, and I was telling Dana, I'm teaching like Sedena development stuff, and you know the development discourse is flooded with that liberalism. You know, that no context, no particularities, no history, no, you know, and the colonial, the word colonial is hardly ever comes up even. But the word culture is all over the place. And the word rights is all over the place. So we do it too. And time and again, you know, now teaching at AGI for 3 years, we have students still, I still grapple with students who still, when we enter the classroom, then deploy, that's a militarized word, culture, then invisibilizes, wipes out everything else, all the other words and all the other stories that actually say so much more. So I don't know, I don't know how to.
I think one of the ways that we need to respond to that is to reclaim quote unquote culture. Because, you know, you're right. Culture is normally associated with Africa.
Yeah.
They don't have culture. Ethnic restaurants, you know, we are the ones that have culture in a very negative way.
Yeah.
They are cultureless. Yeah. We are cultural people, and very negative, you know, perceived in a very negative way. And what we need to do is, first of all, emphasize that they too have a culture.
Yeah.
Our culture is not necessarily all bad. We have very positive aspects of our culture. And we can actually use aspects of that culture to liberate oppressed groups like women. But when, while you were speaking, it reminded me of how coming from a country that is perceived as being par excellence when it comes to homophobia, anti-homosexuality bill, how we were inundated, you know, those of us that are perceived to be sexuality activists, inundated with paparazzi, such as looking for those sound bites. You know, another, you know, African culture, the culture, and completely oblivious to history, as you were saying, you know, colonial history, as if their society is free of homophobia even today. As if it's not only 30, 40 years ago that similar laws were pertaining in there. I mean, and you know, they ask you, so Sylvia, why do you think they're good, this BBC guy? You know, why are you calling me here at 11 our time at night? So why do you think this particular bill is coming out? Why, what is driving the heart? You know, and I'm thinking I'm talking to a sane Logical question.
So I say, you know, several, there's no one reason. Several. One, there's enhanced activism now around the issues of homosexuality. We have a political movement, social movement fighting with this. So they're more visible, more vocal, and therefore more threatening to the status quo. But I gave him like 2 minutes. He kept saying, no. I think he wanted me to say something. He wanted me to talk about culture.
Yes.
Yes, it is African culture. An African, and I wasn't giving him the right chance. It's like, I said, but I've already told you. Is there anything else? It's not as if, where we are, you've never been. I really want you to contextualize this issue and, analyze the colonial stuff, really, it's not, don't look at it historical fashion. But he just couldn't get it. He couldn't get it. This is like, I don't know if he could get it or he didn't want it. It was just a part of sheer ignorance. But yes, they do it all the time. And they don't want to. So it is it's a continuation of the othering process. Okay? Us, sexual democracy, society. Okay. So actually, that is another people who are looking for research opportunities or research topics. I think this whole renaming and so they look at their society as the new modern sexual democracy, and ours as the backward.
Yes.
Okay, and all the questions are constructed that way, and they expect the answers to follow the same mode. It's an uphill battle that we have to fight. So, it's all racism integrated into sexuality and deliberate blinders worn to forget about the history of all this. And then when it comes to, because really sexuality has become an instrument for politicians and religious leaders, not only politicians on the continent, like Mugabe, Museveni, and so on, to divert attention, homosexuality becoming a scapegoat or a red herring, whatever you want to call it, but also for the politicians and religious leaders out there. When politicians out there begin declaring that we are going to turn off the aid taps because unless the anti-homosexuality bill is removed, I think that is instrumentalizing sexuality. But it's used on both sides of it. Yes, I was going to say, with the anti-homosexuality bill, there's been several articles that have been written suggesting that it was made in America. The anti-homosexuality bill was made in America by right-wing Christian fundamentalists in America, the evangelicals there, again suggesting that the political and religious leaders on the continent were passive recipients. Yes, there's some truth in the fact that the anti-homosexuality bill and the current wave of homophobia in the continent has been influenced by right-wing evangelicals from America. But it's not as if the girls who are using it here don't have any agency. Both sides are benefiting immensely from the homophobic, the state-inspired and religious-inspired homophobia, no doubt. So there's so many battles that we have to fight. And they simply refuse. They're talking to a stone wall. Even after, in this one sentence, you tell them, no, it's not that way. The next question will be based on the same premise.